amazing riddle, the road was still moving through a dead world, even though sections of it had been destroyed, apparently by great explosions. We found weapons and human skeletons in the crater-pitted battlefield hidden under that virtual world. That must be the answer. She nodded. The natives worship a black god who came down from the sky with a white consort to create mankind and rule the grand dominion of mankind. A golden age endured until he fell in love with his own creation and took human women. In a jealous rage, the consort turned his white offspring into demons and raised an army of them to revolt against him, finally killing him and destroying all his works. The myth may reflect actual events, though the logic of it seems a little twisted. There's a lot of evidence of violent conflict. Broken walls, fallen towers, enigmatic ruins buried ages ago. I think there was a war between the races. Trouble on her face. She glanced at Kenlith and shook her head. He squirmed uncomfortably and gave me an anxious look. She turned soberly back to me.
Thanks to Tai Chenchi, I'm afraid it's happening again.
Don't blame him, I begged her. He was born with that birthmark, but we didn't come here to make any kind of trouble. The gates were a trap that caught us. We've been lost, wandering, looking for any way back home.
That's what he keeps saying,
she shrugged.
It doesn't matter. He has that shining crown on his forehead. The natives believe he's the predicted son of Anak, sent from heaven to free the slaves and lead them in a conquest of the world.
The slave rebellion? I waited for her to nod. I suppose it is a real threat to Paraclaw, but Ram Chenchi came out of the jungle at the risk of his life to bring an offer to end it. Isn't there a chance for any sort of truce?
He's a fool. Her voice turned violent. A fool to leave his jungle hideout. The slaves will never be freed. He's asking to hang by his ribs with the rest of the rebels.
She clapped her hands and rose. The guards opened the door.
Thank you, Tai Stone, she spread her hands and bowed. You and Tai Chenji have answered questions for me. The Grand Dominion must have been greater than I ever imagined. You've brought tantalizing hints about what brought it down.
A war? What could have been the cause?
A black rebellion.
Her face went bleak.
It killed the Grand Dominion, the civilization that left its ruins in the jungle here. It nearly wiped out all humanity. In spite of the myths, the Dominion was never black. It was a white empire based on slavery. Nothing else could account for all the engineering wonders it created. Minds dulled by manual toil could never have reached the other worlds you describe.
The idea startled me. That's hard to believe. She paused to let me continue. We saw no hint of human slavery on those other worlds. No evidence of any human labor. Those strange roads moved themselves. The Skywire had no human crew. People like us must have lived on the last planet we saw, but they needed no slaves. We found those robots instead, mechanical slaves, waiting to work for whoever knew how to command them.
That's the point,
she stabbed a slim finger at me.
As I told Tai Chenchi, the robots must have left the blacks with nothing to do, unemployed, with no place where they belonged, like idle kids. They turned to mischief. I think they tried to seize the power of the whites, without brains enough to use it. It was their animal stupidity that destroyed the Grand Dominion.
She shrugged and moved to go.
Taiba Krail?
Kenlith rose anxiously.
Are we in bad danger?
Perhaps. She nodded somberly but gave him a wistful smile.
I'll help you if I can.
His gaze followed her fondly as she left the room, and a trace of her lilac scent lingered in the air. Chapter 24. My breakfast next morning was ham and eggs, with a sort of toast and orange juice, a feast I might have enjoyed back at home. Kenlith's dish held a thick yellow slab of something with an uncertain odor. I shared my tray with him.
"The special order," the fat black warden said when the guards brought us to his office. "Compliments of Tiber Krail." He grinned. You have a friend. I wasn't sure of that, even when he added, she wants to see you again.
Two rickshaws stood waiting outside his office, each with two hot men yoked to the pole. He released us to a pale brown officer sitting in one. Kenlith squeezed with me into the narrow seat of the other. The men ran with us to the prison gate and out through the avenues of Paraclaw, which I had never seen.
It's exciting!
Eyes shining, Kenlith looked to the right and left.
My mother lived here.
It was a white stone city, roofed with clay-red tile, the balconied buildings no more than 3 or 4 stories tall. The streets were wide, lined with trees and blooming shrubs. They swarmed with slaves yoked to rickshaws, slaves harnessed to two-wheeled carts and heavy wagons, slaves carrying jars and boxes on their heads. Yet, save for the muffled hum of human voices, the city seemed strangely silent. Muscle power is noiseless, and Paraclaw had no mechanized transport. Silent and strangely peaceful. If the Black Rebellion was a threat, I saw no shadow of it. From a street that took us to a higher level, I caught a glimpse of the harbor and the twin city on the other side. Freighters lined the docks, but I saw no battlecraft, no hint of coming war. An artist might have made it a scene of peace, the silver-bright canals branching from the riverbank, the white Shekko spire standing on its river islet beyond the ruined bridge and causeway, the flat green delta plantations stretching on as far as I could see. Nearer, slaves at the commercial docks were as busy as ants, loading cargoes for Norlan. Our black runners seemed docile, even cheerful, calling soft greetings to friends they met. Paraclaw looked secure, Ram's peace mission tragically forlorn. The museum stood beyond a long pool of water lilies and well-cut lawns. We left the rickshaws at the white-columned entrance. The officer escorted us up the wide stone steps. Inside, we waited at the doorway until a yellow-clad mulatto girl brought Tiber Krail to accept our custody. In a neat white cap and jacket, she was still brightly attractive, still an enigma to me. She had a quick smile for Kenlith and opened her hands to me in a brisk official manner. I caught a hint of her lilac scent. She took us into her office, itself almost a museum. Native artifacts hung along the walls. Reed baskets, enormous hats, colorful rugs, knives and spears, and prayer mats. She nodded me into a seat before her desk, which faced a great window that looked out across the harbor. The desk held a sheaf of papers, a stack of slates, and an odd two-handled drinking cup. Standing by my chair, Kenlith saw it and caught his breath.
"My mother," he whispered. "She had that. Lovely, isn't it?"
She picked it up very carefully and held it for me to see. It looked like fine white porcelain, the lip rimmed with gold. The handles were green, shaped like palm leaves. One side held the image of a black head that looked almost like Ram's, even to a golden fleck for the crown of worlds on the forehead. The woman's ivory head on the other side could have been modeled from hers, a flake of black for the crown.
"Shekko and Anak," she turned to Kenlith. "You've seen it before?" "My mother traded her diamond ring for it," he said. "It came from a tomb. Ty Hake sold it to a man from Paraclaw." "A unique item," she said. "We bought it for the Grand Dominion collection."
Kenlith's eyes were still fixed on it.
"My mother," he made a sad face, "I think she's dead."
She set it back on the desk and turned gravely to face me.
"I'm removing you from the prison," she said, "for your own safety." Who would hurt us?" Kenlith asked her. "We aren't hurting anybody."
"People who fear Tai Chenji. They want to believe his story is a lie. If they got rid of him and silenced you..." She paused to frown at me.
"They think that could end the slave rebellion." "I'm afraid for us," his anxious eyes fixed on her face. "I'm afraid for Ty Rab."
"You are in danger," she nodded soberly. "But you should be safer with me."
"Thank you."
A wistful smile lit his eyes.
"I love you, Tiber Krail."
"Don't say that."
Her face hardened as if he had offended her. His smile went out. His color was wrong for such emotion. She turned the cup on her desk and sat for a moment with her eyes on the black god's image before she looked back at me.
You understand your danger?
With the little I know, I'm trying to.
I've talked to Tai Chenchi.
Her smile held a flash of warmth. She paused thoughtfully, and I saw her glance at my watch.
You've confirmed what he tells me. I suppose our planet is as much of a puzzle to the two of you as your Earth might be to me.
Puzzle enough. I'd begun to like her.
I've been briefing Tai Chenchi, she said. Perhaps we should review a little more of our history.
She pushed the cup back to its place and sat a moment organizing what she meant to say.
The Hotland continent was discovered 10 generations ago. The jungles and people here on the East Coast seemed so hostile that the first explorers passed it by. The West Coast seemed more inviting. Gold was discovered in the sands of the dry riverbeds, in the narrow desert strip between the mountains and the sea. Adventurers came to wash out the gold and abandoned their shanty towns when it was gone. Settlement of the East Coast didn't begin until generations later. One of my own forefathers was on the first ship to sail into the Blood. He led a group ashore on the Delta and stayed behind to live with a native tribe. He learned languages and guided later expeditions up the river.
He left 2 sons, who became captains in the Norland fleet. The elder turned pirate, preying on the river commerce. He built the first fort on the Delta. The younger stayed loyal, captured the fort, hanged his brother, and became one of the first Delta planters. His son organized the first colonial assembly to speak for the planters' rights. The High Commission, appointed by Norlan, stands against the Blood River Authority, which is elected by the planters. My father heads the authority now. He tries to keep some kind of peace with the Commission. Never easy. She shrugged and made a face.
Norlan claims the whole continent, but it has never actually controlled anything beyond Paraclaw, the Delta, and a few spots along the river. The Commission tries to prohibit tax and control everything it can reach. The authority fights for free speech, free trade, free traffic on the river. We dream of total independence, which Norlan will never grant.
The slave rebellion is the big issue now.
Norlan sneers at Chenji and his talk of a truce. They want to believe he's a fraud, that his shining mark is some kind of weird tattoo. They want to hang him and crush the revolt with military force. They expect an army and a fleet from Glacier Bay.
She was speaking freely now, as if quoting arguments she had made to some Norlan authority.
We colonials feel a little differently. The Norlanders might go hungry if their food imports were cut off, but their lives are not in danger. Here on the river we live side by side with the slaves, at their mercy if they want to kill us. Planter families have already been slaughtered, and Chenji...
Absently turning the cup to study the black god's head, she frowned and sighed.
I want to trust him. But he's a problem I don't know how to solve. He denies that he's any supernatural being, but he can't explain the way that sacred mark glows at night. The natives are convinced that he was sent down from the sky to lead the rebellion and restore the Grand Dominion. And you, Tai Stone,
she looked up from the cup to frown at me,
you and Chenji will live or die together. Without you to prove his story of the sacred gates and all those other worlds beyond them, he'd hang today. Without your tie to him, you could die for sedition. The two of you have persuaded me. Others are harder to sway, but most of those who want to hang him now are willing to listen when I tell them that a dead martyr could do more for the rebels than a live captive.
Turning the cup again, she shook her head at Sheko's image as if it had spoken. So, what will happen now? I couldn't help asking that anxious question. What do you expect?
Who knows?
She shrugged, her lips drawn tight.
Chenji sees no peace without a truce, with some plan to end slavery. We can't afford that. Our lives depend on slavery. Our whole culture is built on it. Yet the revolt is already killing us. Responsible planters in the assembly are hoping for some sort of compromise that will bring peace with the free tribes and let their lives go on. Feelings are high. Norlan could lose the continent that feeds it. We colonials could lose our lives. No matter whether Chenji is a divine son of Anak or just a clever liar, both sides blame him for the crisis. Those who fear him fear you just as much. That's the way things stand. She pushed the cup aside. No good for anybody. But I thought you ought to know.
She had smiled again at Kenlith.
Anak, aid you, Tiber Krail.
Voice quavering, he opened his hands and bowed to her.
If you can save us. I have your custody, she said. I'm taking you to my home.
Chapter 25 Rickshaws waited at the museum door. She got into one and led the way. Kenlith and I followed in another, with two branded mulatto guards running behind us. We came into a section of wider streets and impressive mansions, with garden parks or high stone walls around them. We stopped outside a thick, barred, wrought iron gate.
You'll meet my people,
she spoke while we waited for a black keeper to open the gate.
My father is chairman of the assembly. He owns a Delta plantation with 2,000 slaves. My mother's an Ice Cape heiress. She didn't want you in the house, but my father insisted and people are curious. She has invited guests for dinner.
Eyes narrowed critically, she surveyed me, my ragged beard and uncut hair, my soiled and tattered clothing.
Dress for the affair is formal.
The gate swung open. Inside, a wide pavement curved to a marble-columned portico. A black butler in spotless white met us at the door and fixed Kenlith with a scornful stare.
You will leave the boy, she said. He is not permitted in the house. He will sleep in the slave quarters.
He's not a slave, I told her. He stays with me. She frowned severely.
Residence in Paraclaw is limited to whites. Others are not allowed.
His mother was white.
He is not. Her voice grew sharper. Resident non-whites must be registered, licensed, and numbered. They are commonly branded.
I saw Kenlith flinch as if he could see the hot iron coming. His mother was born here in Paraclaw. Her father was an authority official. She had to leave the city before he was born to save her life and his. He didn't choose the color of his skin.
His misfortune, she shrugged. The law is the law. Custom is custom. Our ways are our own.
Kenlith stays with me, I said, or I stay with him.
Out of the question, her face set. I have your custody. I am responsible for your security.
I'll take my chances. I put my arm around him. He's with me. Call him my son.
She shook her head, sternly impatient. That could cost you rights you're going to need.
I drew him closer. She faced me for half a minute, anger smoldering in her eyes.
Your choice, at last she shrugged. His registration can be delayed.
Thank you, Tiber Krail.
He tried to smile at her, but she had turned away. At a sharp word from her, the black butler shrugged and escorted us up a marble stair to a corner room on the third floor. He shut the door and left us there alone. Kenlith put his arms around me. I felt his heart thumping.
Thank you, Ty Will, he whispered. I don't like it here.
He stared around him in uneasy wonder. The walls were high, and the room seemed enormous. Mosquito nets hung around a huge four-poster at the center of the floor. White lace curtained tall glass doors that looked across a railed balcony to a sea of red-tiled roofs that ran down to the broad brown river and a far line of green plantations.
My mother had pictures, he said. She lived in places like this. She grieved for her twin brother and the friends she had to leave. I think she was sorry she ever had me, but I do miss her, terribly.
I myself was longing just as keenly for news of Ram, for news of Derek and Lupe, wherever they were, longing even for my students and my university friends and the tiny crises we used to debate in the Faculty Senate. Earth had become an impossible dream. The lock had clicked when the butler left. I tried the door. It didn't yield. I felt a sudden sense of suffocation. We'd been confined too long. Wanting to get out and walk, wanting sun and space and air to breathe, I rapped on the door. After an endless wait, a huge mulatto guard appeared.
"To go outside?" His eyes rolled in astonishment. "Die, you have no permission."
He closed the door and the lock clicked again. To endure the empty time, we gave each other language lessons. I recited my scraps of Shakespeare, and we tried to translate. Kenlith listened avidly when I tried to answer his questions about Elizabethan England. Earth must have been as strange and wonderful to him as the universe of the Trilithons had been to me. The door opened late that afternoon, and quiet black servants came in to ready me for dinner. A silent barber shaved me and cut my hair. A black valet measured me as carefully as a tailor back at home and came back with the Norlan equivalent of a tux, a tight white jacket, tight white hose that came above my knees, a green silk sash embroidered with the Crail monogram. The butler escorted me down the spiral stair to a spacious hall and steered me to my place at a long dining table, elaborately set with hand-painted china and gleaming silver that had come from Ice Cape. Scented candles already burned in the gold chandelier above it. The guests had not arrived. I stood behind my chair until Celia Crail appeared. In a white silk gown, she looked as fresh and chic as a film starlet back home. She inspected me critically, adjusted the sash, and showed me around the hall. The high walls were hung with solemn portraits of the Crail dynasty. In a moment of family pride, she pointed out paintings of a Crail freight steamer, the Crail sugar mill, and a steam locomotive on the Crail railway, which ran out of the delta to the coal fields and silver mines 100 miles north. Her family came in. Her father was a tall, austere whitebeard who eyed me sharply through a gold-rimmed monocle he wore on a chain. He gave me a stiff formal bow and turned to mutter sharply at her. She murmured something that made him smile. Her mother was a lean, hawk-featured woman who wore chalk-white makeup and a crown of bright orange hair. With only an absent nod for me, she turned angrily to scold the butler for a fault I couldn't fathom. Celia introduced the guests when they came in, a uniformed commander from the constabulary, an intelligence officer and his wife, the secretary of the River Authority, 2 commissioners from the High Council, a wizened river magnate who owned a stable of racing slaves, Crail's banker, a licensed quadroon whose fat fingers glittered with diamonds and gold. And they gave me casual nods or searching squints or formal bows or stares of cold disbelief, but never an open hand of friendship. Ram's testimony before the council was still in progress. Some of the guests had questions of their own. Was it true, the intelligence officer asked, that we had come together from that magic planet in the sky? Had I seen any actual evidence that Chenji's great-grandmother had been an escaped Delta slave? Had he brought magic weapons with him? With his shrewd eyes on my face, he asked about our missing companions, the magician Ironsmith and his female assistant. Did they really know the secrets of thunder and lightning? Had they really been able to speak to each other around the world? Where were they now? Hiding in the jungle, perhaps? Casting evil spells for the rebels? He shrugged at last and walked away. A scornful engineer probed me for more about the magic gates. How had we been able to jump between those worlds in the sky with no wings to lift us or bridges to walk across? The commander had searching questions about the elders. Were they themselves warriors or priests of Anak and Sheko? Did they command the rebels? It was a grim little comedy. None of them believed anything I said. They were trying to trick me into contradicting Ram's testimony. If the situation hadn't been so terrible, I could have laughed at the technological backwardness that made fairy tales of all I tried to tell them about the Earth and all the marvels we had seen since we left it. A red-haired quadroon artist made me pose for a quick charcoal sketch. She worked for the Crail newspaper. Seeming a little more open than most of the others, she wanted to interview me about Earth and my life there when she could get permission. She never did. Waiters were offering glasses of some fiery stuff from the Crail distillery. With no response at all when Celia tried to introduce me, the River Authority executive reached for a glass and turned to ask the commander about harbor security. "No concern," and the commander shrugged. "The fleet will soon be here with troops to reclaim the river and put the trouble down." Standing near, Crail had overheard.
"We do need support from Norland, but mark my word..." He raised the monocle to glare at me and turned to shake his head at the commander. "I've heard too much of that odd blackbird and his puppets. We'll have no peace on the river so long as they are allowed to sing."
"True, sir." The commander raised his glass and shouted for a toast. "Death to that black demon and all the witches with him. Death to all their jungle thugs and every traitor who seeks to aid or arm them." People turned to stare. I felt relieved when a troop of black musicians filed in. They were natives, Celia announced, that the museum had brought to display the culture of an isolated tribe in the Northwest Mountains. Their tunes were a harsh cacophony to me, but they must have expressed their loyalty to Paraclaw. They got polite applause. The butler held a gong for Crail to strike. His voice high and thin with age, he asked us to stand and began the meal with thanks to the unknown Creator for all his bountiful blessings and a prayer for him to cleanse the errant soul of every traitor with the pain of holy fire.
"Please remain standing," he said, "for a moment of silence in memory of Benkir Vah, a daring explorer and a great friend of mine. You may have seen his collections of prehistoric antiquities in the Hall of Ancient Art. He never returned from his last expedition into the unmapped area north of the Blood. I've just learned that he is dead."
"Killed by the Slubro Slubrok," Celia told me, "a jungle parasite, also called the gutworm."
A young waitress, uniformed in something stiff and white, stood rigidly silent behind every chair. I was placed at the foot of the table, between the intelligence officer and the engineer. The engineer shuddered and asked if Var's party could have brought infection back.
"No danger," Celia said. "None of them got back. A rescue expedition has just returned with the tragic news. They found Var's records and cameras in his last camp. Fortunately, they escaped infection."
"A nasty bug," the officer muttered. "Chenji himself makes no threats, but he suggests that the rebels might attempt to use disease as a weapon. The medical corps is considering that possibility."
He turned to me as if he expected some response. Afraid anything I said might somehow damage Ram, I kept silent. With nothing to say that he might believe, I felt relieved when the actual meal began. The waitress at my place was young and lovely, probably an octoroon, her license number tattooed on her pale cream forehead. She bowed and smiled and said her name was Sherlith.
"I serve you, sir," she breathed at my ear. "Ask for what you wish."
What I wished for at the moment was Norland table manners. My place was set with a vast gold plate surrounded with a bewildering array of silk napkins, bowls and cups and glasses, silver knives and forks and spoons. With no skills for them, I watched the engineer for clues. He seemed amused when he saw me aping him, and I relaxed a little when it struck me that really I need not worry. Good etiquette could have condemned me as a native Norlander, a traitor to my race. The meal came in many courses, elaborate dishes accompanied with a series of alcoholic drinks. Sherlith served me with an eager zeal, refilling every glass or dish I touched, asking what was wrong when I could only taste the liquors and toy with the food. My hopeless depression had killed my appetite. No matter whether the council hanged Ram or set him free, I saw that he could never bring an end to slavery. This whole world was built on it. Call these people good or evil or in between, they would fight to the death to defend it.
Chapter 26
The screams of a woman under torture woke me next morning. They continued for nearly 2 hours, broken with sounds of strangling and gasping cries for mercy. I felt sick and jittery before at last they ceased. Kenlith had slept on the floor, but he woke, crawled into the bed, and lay trembling against me. It was Charlotte who entered with our breakfast tray when the guard unlocked the door. She looked drawn and nervous, her eyes puffy and red. Silently, she set our meal on a little table. I couldn't help asking if she had heard the screaming.
"Nobody screamed," she whispered. "Perhaps a happy child was singing." "She was hurting," Kenlith shook his head. "Bad. Maybe dying. I was frightened. I have no license. Could I be next?" "You won't be," she tried to smile. "Not now."
"What happened?" I asked. "Can't you say?" Her swollen eyes fixed on me.
"You are a friend of Chenchi?"
I heard a desperate plea in her voice.
"He is the true son of Anak and will set us free?"
"If he can."
"I pray to Anak."
Her slender fingers made a fleeting sign. She paused to peer into my eyes.
"You will not speak?"
"I promise." She glanced at the door to be certain it was shut.
"My sister."
Her voice fell and her words came fast.
"Ty Krail chose her to bathe him, favored her too greatly. Tyba hated her for that. Tyba told Butler she found her coupling with him in the tub. Not true, but Butler fears Tyba. Ty Krail," she tried to stifle a sob, "he wants no quarrel with Tyba."
She stifled a sob and dropped to her knees.
"Ty," she whispered, "may I serve you now?"
Kenlith tried to put his arms around her. She shook her head and pushed him away. I let her serve our breakfast. Her hands shaking, she spilled a few drops of tea and cried out as if in pain. She wiped her eyes when we had eaten, gathered up the dishes, slipped silently away. Next morning, another woman brought our breakfast. We never saw Charlotte again. Kenlith was not allowed out of the room, but the valet appeared every afternoon to dress me for dinner. The intelligence officer, Aver Krell, was always there to update Krail on the slave rebellion. A wiry little fox-faced man who spoke a dozen native tongues, he had been a Korath trader and a collector for the museum. Day by day I saw Krail's nerve melt away as he heard the news from Krell. The revolt was spreading down the river toward his Delta holdings. The River Authority reported more violence than they could contain. More planters and traders had been murdered, more towns and factories burned, more refugees were waiting on the riverbanks for rescue. Krell always tried to lift his spirits.
"We're secure, Ty. They can't storm Blood Hill with jungle knives. The constabulary can certainly contain any trouble on the Delta. The advance flotilla of the North Sea fleet is already steaming up the channel."
Krail asked about Chenji. "His fate is still uncertain, sir. The council would vote to hang him at once if not for..." He stopped with a frosty stare toward the foot of the table.
"Frankly, Ty, we face a nasty stalemate. The blacks take Chenji for a son of Anak, sent to throw us off the continent. That white..." He shrugged and scowled at me. "He doubles the dilemma."
I drew a long breath and tried to keep a blank expression. The whole group sat gazing at me until at last Krell proposed a toast to Krail's wife, the uncrowned queen of Paraclaw. Glasses clinked and her cold smile wrenched me with thoughts of Charlotte's sister slave and her shrieks of torture. Krell was back a few nights later with news that the whole fleet was now at anchor in the harbor, with 10,000 men aboard the troop transports under command of General Arca Zorn. "Paraclaw's now secure," he told Krell, "and we're stabbing at the heart of the rebellion. Tribes we never conquered, up north in the Black River Basin, are joining the rebels. Their heads are filled with the poison notion that Chenji's here from heaven to create a new black dominion." The Black River was a major tributary of the Blood, navigable for 1,000 miles into territory that only a few explorers had seen. General Zorn would be pushing up it with 12 gunboats and 4,000 troops. With victory on the black, we can hang the traitors and snuff the trouble out like a dying candle. With no news of Ram, I dreamed that night that we were back at the trading post upriver. I saw him hanging from that twisted oak, blood dripping from the hook through his ribs. He was gasping for water, but blood filled the cup when I got it to his lips. At dinner the next evening, the guests included the Admiral Kutch, General Zorn, and their staff officers, all in full uniform and gleaming with jeweled swords and medals. Zorn was a bronze-haired giant in starch-creased whites and a crimson sash, his voice a raucous bark. A mulatto guard and my nearly white waitress alert behind me, I sat alone at the foot of the table, empty chairs on either side of me. Laughing with the officers, Krell gave me a mocking introduction as the Honorable Ambassador from the magic planet Earth. When the meal was half over, a sudden silence fell. People turned to stare at the door. Celia Krail and Ram stood there, two guards with them.
"Tai Ram Chenshi,"
she caught his arm and turned to face her parents.
"Governor Vollmer has released him in my custody."
In the startled silence, the butler escorted them to the empty places beside me. Limping, leaning on a cane, Ram wore yellow-striped prison coveralls. His face bruised and swollen, he had a white bandage taped across his forehead where the crown of worlds had been. He stopped behind his chair and gave me a dismal shrug. Krell murmured to Zorn and the Admiral,
"That black devil!"
Zorn was on his feet, stabbing a furious finger at Ram. "What's he doing here?" Krail gaped at him and then at Celia.
"General, Tai Chenshi is my guest." She caught Ram's arm. "The council inquiry is still in progress. We have evidence that he and Tai Stone are what they claim to be, travelers from another world who meant no harm to us."
"A monstrous fraud!"
Zorn blinked at her, then at Ram and me.
"They'll hang for it."
"Perhaps," she shrugged. "Charges have been filed against both him and Tai Stone. They are not yet convicted of anything, but their lives have been in danger. I have accepted custody to protect them."
"Wasn't Chenshi safe in prison?"
"Not safe, Tai. Intelligence exposed a plot to kill him."
"Is that true?"
Zorn swung his fury to Krell.
"In prison?"
The little intelligence man cringed and braced himself. "Tai, a guard, was bribed to knife him. He disarmed and disabled the guard. His food was poisoned.
He lay near death in the prison hospital until Tai Basilia brought her doctors to save his life."
"Who would kill him?"
"The culprit has not been identified."
Krell glanced down the table at us.
"These men have enemies everywhere." "General Zorn,"
beside me Celia raised her voice,
"Tai Chenshi is more than my guest. He is a weapon against the rebels. He has traveled in the jungle. He has met the elders, leaders of the wild tribes that support the enemy. He has given us valuable information about their positions and resources."
"Or misinformation," Zorn huffed.
"The story of his arrival on Mount Anak has been well substantiated."
"By that white traitor?"
He glared at me.
"And others, Tai. His best witness is the double agent known as Toran."
"Double agent?"
Zorn scowled at her.
"Whose agent? Yours or theirs?"
She looked at Krell, who flushed and caught his breath before he spoke.
"Tai, we trust the man. He has been a useful asset for many years. He led the group that saw Tai Chenshi and Tai Stone appear on Mount Anak. He has penetrated the rebel leadership. His reports have been reliable."
"If you think they are actual magicians from this magic earth," Zorn glowered at him, "I think they've enchanted you. I know they've inspired the rebellion. They're a blade in our gut."
A troop of waiters had appeared with platters of broiled quail. The scent sharpened my appetite in spite of the tension, and Krail rapped a glass.
"Gentlemen, can't we let the meal continue?"
One moment, Ty. Soren glared at Ram. If this splendid son of Anak has appeared to arrange the surrender of Paraclaw to a horde of black savages... He clenched his jaws in indignation and stopped to squint at Ram. Can't he speak for himself? Celia nodded at Ram. He gave me a wry shrug and turned to face Zorn. Ty, his voice rasped and he cleared his throat. Ty Stone and I never asked to be here. I'm not the son of any god. I never claimed to be. Yet you wore a mark of magic power. The birthmark. He touched the bandage across his forehead. I've always had it. A small pale freckle. Nothing uncommon, though it had the shape of a crown. Only an accident, I think. But it has been taken for the fulfillment of a prophecy. Nothing uncommon, Zorn's harsh voice sharpened. Wasn't it shining in the dark? That's why they cut it out. How did you get it? I was born with it. He said nothing of his black great-grandmother and her story of escape from another world. Zorn scowled at him and bent to hear something from Krell. I am told you command the rebels. Not true, Ty. Some of them may claim me for a leader, but I have no authority. I have met native people and heard their legends of a great civilization destroyed by war. I came out of the jungle hoping for a peace that would stop it from happening again. I think you're a liar or a fool. Likely both. With a nod to Krayl, Zorn sat down. Krayl clinked his glass. Frozen waiters came to life, refilling glasses and serving the quail. The silent guests relaxed and talked again. Ram grinned at me. I reached to take his hand. He stiffened and drew back. Celia frowned at me, her lips set tight.
No contact between you is allowed.
Chapter 27 Ram was back every evening at dinner, the guards and Celia with him, seated near me at the foot of the table. A white bandage still crossed his forehead, but the bruises had healed. The prison stripes were gone, but he looked no happier in his starched and creased formal attire. Sometimes he winked or gave me a grim little nod. But we were not allowed to speak. Her parents coldly ignored him, but she sat beside him, smiled at him, introduced him to other guests as if he were a welcome friend. The guards were always close. We saw no more of Zorn. Determined to stab the rebels to the heart, he had gone up the Black River with his gunboats, an infantry battalion, a long-range rocket battery, support troops, and a shipload of crawler cannon. His gunboats, meeting no resistance, were already near Shekko Falls at the head of navigation. Krell, the intelligence officer, was always there to share war news with Krayl. A second flotilla was steaming up the Blood River to pick up refugees and relieve besieged outposts. Admiral Cooch was often back, a heavy, deliberate man with a hearty appetite and shrewd green eyes and a smooth, bland face. He was full of good humor and basking happily in his popularity as the champion defender of the nation. Careful with his ships and his men, he would have been a winning poker player. He held half his fleet in reserve, still at anchor in the harbor. He had spoken in the council to oppose Zorn's adventure. I've known Aki Zorn since we were cadets, he told Krayl. He always liked to fight and fought to win. He half killed himself working to stay at the top of his class. But I'm uneasy for him now. He's never known the jungle. Fighting jungle.